Chapter 3. We were torpedoed at about 3 o'clock in the morning on April 6, 1942, 2 days after leaving Panama. I was thrown from the top bunk and suddenly found myself on my hands and knees on the deck. We could hear the ship's whistle blowing constantly, and there were sounds of metal wrenching and much shouting. The whole ship was shuddering. It felt as though we'd stopped and were dead in the water. My mother was very calm, not at all like she was at home. She talked quietly while she got dressed, telling me to tie my shoes and be certain to carry my wool sweater and to put on my leather jacket. Her hands were not shaking. She helped me put on my life jacket, then put hers on, saying, "Now remember everything that we were told about abandoning ship." The officers had held drills every day. As she was speaking, there was another violent explosion. We were thrown against the cabin door, which the steward had warned us not to lock because it might become jammed. We pushed it open and went out to the boat deck, which was already beginning to tilt. Everything was bright red, and there were great crackling noises. The entire after part of the ship was on fire, and sailors were launching the lifeboat that was on our deck. Steam lines had broken, and the steam was hissing out. Heat from the fire washed over us. When the lifeboat had been swung out, the captain came down from the bridge. He was a small, wiry, white-haired man, and was acting the way I'd been told captains should act. He stood by the lifeboat in the fire's glow, very alert, giving orders to the crew. He was carrying a briefcase and a navigation instrument I knew to be a sextant. On the other side of the ship, another lifeboat was being launched. Near us, two sailors with axes chopped at lines, and two big life rafts plunged toward the water, which looked black, except for pools of fire from burning fuel oil. The captain shouted, "Get a move on! Passengers into the boats!" Tins of lubricating oil in the afterholds had ignited and were exploding, but the ones forward had not been exposed to the fire. A sailor grabbed my mother's hand and helped her in, and then I felt myself being passed into the hands of a sailor on the boat. The other passengers were helped in, and someone yelled, "Lower away!" At that moment, the Hato lurched heavily, and something happened to the boat falls. The bow tilted downward, and the next thing I knew, we were all in the water. I saw my mother near me and yelled to her. Then something hit me from above. A long time later, 4 hours I was told, I opened my eyes to see blue sky above. It moved back and forth, and I could hear the slap of water. I had a terrible pain in my head. I closed my eyes again, thinking maybe I was dreaming. Then a voice said, "Young Bass, how are you feeling?" I turned my head. I saw a huge, very old Negro sitting on the raft near me. He was ugly. His nose was flat and his face was broad. His head was a mass of wiry gray hair. For a moment I could not figure out where I was, or who he was. Then I remembered seeing him working with the deck gang of the Hato. I looked around for my mother, but there was no one else on the raft. Just this huge Negro, myself, and a big black and gray cat that was licking his haunches. The Negro said, "You are a most terrible crack on the head, boss. A strong back glance off in your head and I'll you aboard this raft." He crawled over toward me. His face couldn't have been blacker, or his teeth whiter. They made an alabaster trench in his mouth, and his pink-purple lips peeled back over them like the meat of a conch shell. He had a big welt like a scar on his left cheek. I knew he was West Indian. I had seen many of them in Willemstad, but he was the biggest one I'd ever seen. I sat up, asking, "Where are we? Where is my mother?" The Negro shook his head with a frown. "I true believe your mother is safe and sound on a raft like this. Or maybe they haul her into the boat. I true believe that." Then he smiled at me, his face becoming less terrifying. "As to our very location, I must guess we are somewhere around the Keys. Somewhere maybe 15 latitude and 80 long. We should have passed them till that most treacherous torpedo split the very hull. 2 minutes dong at the most." I looked all around us. There was nothing but blue sea with occasional patches of orange-brown seaweed. No sight of the Hato, or other rafts, or boats. Just the sea, and a few birds that wheeled over it. That lonely sea, and the sharp pains in my head, and the knowledge that I was here, alone with a black man, instead of my mother, made me break into tears. Finally, the black man said, looking at me from bloodshot eyes, "Now, young boss, I most feel like that my own self, Timothy, but 'twould be of no particular use to do that, eh?" His voice was rich calypso, soft and musical, the words rubbing off like velvet. I felt a little better, but my head ached fiercely. He nodded toward the cat. "This is Stew, the cook's cat. He climb on the raft and I had no art to throw him off." Stew was still busy licking. "He got oil all over hisself from the water." I looked closer at the black man. He was extremely old, yet he seemed powerful. Muscles rippled over the ebony of his arms and around his shoulders. His chest was thick, and his neck was the size of a small tree trunk. I looked at his hands and feet. The skin was alligatored and cracked, tough from age and walking barefoot on the hot decks of schooners and freighters. He saw me examining him, and said gently, "Put your head back down, young boss, and rest a while longer. Do not look direct at the sun, 'tis too powerful." I felt seasick and crawled to the side to vomit. He came up beside me, holding my head in his great clamshell hands. It didn't matter at that moment that he was black and ugly. He murmured, "This be good, this be good." When it was over, he helped me back to the center of the raft, saying, "'Tis most natural for you to do this. 'Tis the shock of having all this most terrible thing happen." I then watched as he used his powerful arms and hands to rip up boards from the outside edges of the raft. He pounded them back together on cleats, forming two triangles. Then he jammed the bases into slots between the raft boards. He stripped off his shirt and his pants, then demanded mine. I don't know what happened to my leather jacket or my sweater, but soon we had a flimsy shelter from the burning sun. Crawling under it to sprawl beside me, he said, "We have rare good luck, young boss. The water keg did not bust when the raft was launch, and we have a few biscuit, some chocolate, and the matches in the tin is dry. So we have rare good luck." He grinned at me then. I was thinking that our luck wasn't so good. I was thinking about my mother on another boat or raft, not knowing I was all right. I was thinking about my father back in Willemstad. It was terrible not to be able to tell him where I was. He'd have boats and planes out within hours. I guess the big Negro saw the look on my face. He said, "Do not be despair, young boss. Someone will find us. Many schooner go by this way, and this also be the ship track to Jamaica and on." After a bit, lulled by the bobbing of the raft and by the soft, pleasant sounds of the sea against the oil barrel floats, I went to sleep again. I was very tired, and my head still ached. The piece of timber must have struck a glancing blow on the left side. When I next awakened, it was late afternoon. The sun had edged down and the breeze across us was cool, but I felt very hot, and the pain had not gone away. The Negro was sitting with his back toward me, humming something in calypso. His back was a great wall of black flesh, and I saw a cruel scar on one shoulder. I asked, "What is your name?" Hearing my voice, he turned with a wide grin. "Ah, you are back with me. It has been lonesome these very hours." I repeated, "What is your name?" "My own self, Timothy." "Your last name?" He laughed. "I have but one name, 'tis Timothy." "Mine is Philip Enright, Timothy." My father had always taught me to address anyone I took to be an adult as Mister, but Timothy didn't seem to be a Mister. Besides, he was black. He said, "I knew a Philip who fish out of St. John, but an outrageous man he was." He laughed deep inside himself. I asked him for a drink of water. He nodded agreeably, saying, "The sun do parch." He lifted a hinged section of the raft flooring and drew out the keg, which was about 2 feet long. There was a tin cup lashed to it. Careful not to spill a drop, he said, "'Tis best to have only an outrageous small amount, just enough to wet the tongue." "Why?" I asked. "That is a large keg." He scanned the barren sea and then looked back at me, his old eyes growing remote. "The large keg have a way of losing its very size." "You said we would be picked up soon," I reminded him. "Ah, yes," he said instantly. "But we must be wise about what we have." I drank the tiny amount of water he'd poured out and asked for more. He regarded me silently a moment, then said, his eyes squinting, "A very little more, young baas." My lips were parched and my throat was dry. I wanted a whole cup. "Please fill it up," I said. Timothy poured only a few drops into the bottom. "That isn't enough," I complained. I felt I could drink 3 cups of it. But he pressed the wooden stopper firmly back into the keg, ignoring me. I said, "I must have water, Timothy. I'm very hot." Without answering, he opened the trap in the raft and secured the keg again. It was then that I began to learn what a stubborn old man he could be. I began to dislike Timothy. "Young baas," he said, coming back under the shelter, "maybe before the night, a schooner will pass this way, and if that happens, you may drink the whole keg. Maybe the schooner will not pass this way, so we must make our water last." I said defiantly, "A schooner will find us, and my father has ships out looking for us." Without even glancing at me, he answered, "True, young baas." Then he closed his eyes and would not speak to me any more. He just sprawled out, a mound of silent black flesh. I couldn't hold the tears back. I'm sure he heard me, but he didn't move a muscle of his face. Neither did he look up when I crawled out from under the shelter to get as far away from him as I could. I stayed on the edge of the raft for a long time, thinking about home and rubbing Stew Cat's back. Although I hadn't thought so before, I was now beginning to believe that my mother was right. She didn't like them. She didn't like it when Henrik and I would go down to St. Anna Bay and play near the schooners, but it was always fun. The black people would laugh at us and toss us bananas or papayas. She'd say, when she knew where we'd been, "They are not the same as you, Philip. They are different and they live differently. That's the way it must be." Henrik, who'd grown up in Curacao with them, couldn't understand why my mother felt this way. I yelled over at him, "You're saving all the water for yourself." I don't think he was asleep, but he didn't answer. When the sky began to turn a deep blue, Timothy roused himself and looked around. He said, with just an unfriendly glance at me, "If luck be, the flying fish will flop on the raft. We can save a few biscuit by eating the fish. 2 water is in the fish." I was hungry, but the thought of eating raw fish didn't appeal to me. I said nothing. Just before dark, they began skimming across the water, their short, wing-like fins taking them on flights of 20 or 30 feet, sometimes more. A large one shot out of the water, skimmed toward us, and then slammed into the raft flooring. Timothy grabbed it, shouting happily. He wrapped its head with his knife handle and tossed it beneath the shelter. Soon another came aboard, not so large. Timothy grabbed it too. Before total darkness, he had skinned them, deftly cutting meat from their sides. He handed me the 2 largest pieces. "Eat them," he ordered. I shook my head. He looked at me in the fading light and said softly, "We will have no other food tonight. You best eat them, young baas." With that, he pressed a piece of the fish against his teeth, sucking at it noisily. Yes, they were different. They ate raw fish. I turned away from him, over on my stomach. I thought about Curacao, warm and safe, about our gabled house in Charlu, and about my father. Suddenly I blamed my mother because I was on the raft with this stubborn old black man. It was all her fault. She'd wanted to leave the island. I blurted out. I wouldn't even be here with you if it wasn't for my mother. I knew Timothy was staring at me through the darkness when he said, She started this terrible war, eh, young boss? He was a shadowy shape across the raft.